I love this play. I think this play is completely fabulous. Let's talk about it from the point of view of how it relates to Pericles, how it relates to history and genre, and also look at some specific elements within the play. Let me first ask you whether reading Cymbeline was easier for you because we had discussed Pericles. Can you see points of connection between Pericles and Cymbeline? Yes.
I would say it's more difficult for me, and I think the thing that made Pericles such an easy read was the narrator in between the scenes.
Uh-huh.
And that really helped all of that story to knit and flow. Whereas this story, I had to be paying pretty careful attention to characters' names and what they were saying and
right.
where the action was.
Right. Okay, good. Good. Any other kind of primary responses? Am I alone in the room in my admiration for this work? Can I see a general show of hands of people who are inclined to like it? Very good. This is... Thank you. Okay. You actually want to say something. Good. Cool.
Out of all the plays, I was kind of perplexed as to why it was called Cymbeline, because he seemed like one of the characters that was the least prevalent throughout the play.
Why is the play called Cymbeline? For similar reasons, I think, to why Henry IV Part I and Henry IV Part II are called Henry IV rather than Prince Hal, who is the main character of those plays. In those cases, it is the name of the ruling king. And this is, to a certain extent, a history play. And so it's a little bit about the reign of King Cymbeline. I think that's why it has the title that it has. But we've seen that also titles are rather erratic in this period, that sometimes they seem to fit the play very well and sometimes less well. What would you have called the play if you were Shakespeare?
The first thing that came to my mind was that it should have been about or named after Posthumus and Imogen, because it seemed more about their relationship and the surrounding events that happened because of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the love comedies that we have mostly don't bear the names of them. I mean, As You Like It isn't called Rosalind and Orlando, or Twelfth Night isn't called Viola and Orsino, or Olivia and Sebastian, or whatever it is. They tend to have different kinds of names if it's a comedy. But this is very demonstrably a tragic comedy. It has tragic elements, it has comic elements, it has historical elements. Maybe we should start by kind of collecting what some of these things are, because you should recognize in this play many things that are familiar to us from the world of fairy tale, of romance, the wicked stepmother, the boys who've been stolen away and turn out to be the king's sons and so forth. It's a kind of collection of these tropes or generic cliches. But maybe we should kind of go through just to begin with and kind of count out the ways in which the play might be called a history play, the ways in which it might be called a tragedy, the ways in which it might be called a comedy. What are its historical elements? Yes?
I'd say, first of all, the conflict or the relationship between Rome and Britain.
Ah, good, okay. There's a war between Rome and Britain. The question is, what's at issue between them?
Britain was supposed to be paying a certain amount of money to
paying
Rome.
Tribute.
Because
yes,
Julius
exactly.
Caesar had conquered Britain, and now Augustus Caesar is on the scene, and he's looking for his money.
Okay, so
they don't want to give it to them.
We have Augustus. We have money, I'm going to use a sign not recognizable to them. And we have Cymbeline in ancient Britain. And the question is whether or not you should pay the tribute. Now, Cymbeline is an ancient king of Britain. King Cymbeline. This little history about Julius and Augustus tells us a number of things. It tells us that there's Rome, but it also tells you about a particular moment in the history of Rome. If it's the time of Augustus, what time is it in Christian time? It's the time of the birth of Christ. So it's very overdetermined in terms of its temporal setting, that it's about a crisis between Rome and Britain. You have the sense of the ancient heritages of each, and you have not quite mentioned, but not really in the background either, with all this language about sacrifice and about humble birth and noble birth and discovery and so forth. You have not very hidden this other story of a miraculous discovery and something that was thought to be dead and is not dead. And I mean, this whole kind of notion of the Christian narrative is somewhere back in the prehistory of this. But it's a history play in that it focuses on the question of Britain. What is the capital of Britain in this ancient world? Ludstown, yes, indeed, Ludstown, which is the pre-London Ludstown. Remember that with a history play, we always have at least three time periods. We have the time in which it's set, time in which it's written, time in which it's performed. So if this is the time in which it's set, what can be said about the history of the time in which it is written? Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a time of nationalism.
Of growing nationalism. Right. And who's on the throne in England?
James.
What's James's interest in nationalism here?
Uniting England and Scotland.
Creating Britain, recreating Britain. So that the continuum that began, so to speak, with the story of King Lear, with the dissolution of the kingdom and its breaking up into three parts, like England, Scotland, and Wales, for example. Here we go back into ancient Britain and we find the founding moment of the notion of Britain. And we find, yes, right behind you. Yeah.
I just have an interruption question.
Sure.
James was very interested in uniting England and Scotland, but why not Wales?
Why was he not? Well, he's a Scot.
Right, I know, but just ignore Wales?
Well, sorry?
One thing at a time.
Well, his negotiation was about the unification of England and Scotland.
Right.
This is correct. I can't actually tell you. Maybe Larry or Mel can tell you. Mel probably knows about the history of Wales at this period. Do you?
Well, I think one of the reasons was, I don't know a lot about it, but one of the reasons was probably practical. Heck of a lot easier to unite Scotland and England in some ways than to actually subdue Wales, which was historically impossible to bring under reign.
And can you say why that is?
Well, geography,
right.
Partly.
Right, so it's mountainous. It's also, as always in Shakespeare, the place of poetry somehow. The Welsh woman whom Mortimer marries in Richard II and only sings in Welsh and so forth. The Prince of Wales. It's another place. It's in the comic world of city, country, city, or court, forest, court. It's the wild place. It's the place of where anything can happen. It is in this play also that kind of place of transformation in which Imogen goes dressed as a boy. She goes into this again, this mask-like, the masque-like mask. Mask-like terrain of the cave and where she discovers her heritage without knowing that it's there and so forth. It's this interior world, this world of no rank rather than rank. It's what the anthropologist Victor Turner calls a liminal world or a liminal place, a place on the edge or the threshold. It's a place of non-differentiation. Male, female, high, low, everybody is noble but don't say that they're noble, don't know that they're noble, and so forth. So Wales functions here in the comic world as this place of potential transformation or discovery or whatever. In the historical world, it functions as the place then against which this reunification can, to a certain extent, be happening. And when something, when it's either a murder or a discovery, it's going to take place somehow in Milford Haven. It's going to take place in the world of Wales. but the soldiers are either Romans or Britons. You get that structure that you often get in a Shakespearean history play, like Antony and Cleopatra, where the army of Britain enters at one door and the army of Rome at the other door. You have generals on both sides and so forth. And you have rank as well as law in these. And you have not only rank and law, you also have laws which are going to be overturned, laws that are going to be suspended. You ought to be paying capital punishment for this, but in fact, everybody's pardoned by the end. All shall be pardoned. So we have so King James. Just go back to King James. He's interested in the unification, the reunification of Britain, and the recovery of that heritage. He's also interested in dynasty, in family dynasty, and here we have the story of a king who is both the father and the mother. What am I but mother to the birth of three? Remember that image from Pericles that we had, the I am great with woe and will deliver weeping, that image of Pericles as a king who is also a mother. Here, too, the king, at the moment of the discovery of his lost children, imagines himself in this, what you might think, a very strange phrase, what am I, the mother of the birth of three. But James talked about himself as both the mother and the father of his kingdom, that he is the total parent here. And what is recovered is a family of two sons and a daughter, which happens to be also the structure of James's family. So that what's being repeated on the stage is partly a structure that is historically consonant with the time period in which the play is itself being imagined. For a modern audience, that is, an audience contemporaneous with us, what would you say about what the history side of the play has to offer? New Yorker tell you anything about this? Yes.
Characters come from different periods of history.
Yes.
And that's unique.
Well, so it has that the deliberate anachronism quality that we have learned to see often functions in Shakespearean history plays in modern productions as a way of signifying that this particular war is the sign of all wars. Remember, we talked about how the soldiers might be soldiers in other productions for other plays might be dressed in Civil War garb or in Revolutionary War garb or in Vietnam fatigues or something like that.
That there is something honorable about the ancient Roman Augustinian period as opposed to the kind of Machiavellian aspects of Renaissance.
Of Iachimo, absolutely. Yes, so that we have Italy is both Rome and contemporary Italy in this period. And so you get the Machiavellian villain here, a particularly sleazy version of it and not ultimately a tremendously, I mean, a successful theatrical character, but ultimately somebody who does, you know, give up. He's rather than with Iago falling silent, he apologizes all over himself, says that it's his fault and so forth. He wasn't noble, he behaved badly and so on. So that you have that this what seems anachronistic in the within the context of the play, this contemporary to Shakespeare's time, theatrical cliche, the cliche of the Machiavellian plotting Italian figure. Yes?
I have a question. It's just at the beginning, with the sons disappearing, with his wife dying, Cymbeline seems to be, you know, inept.
Uh-huh.
And inept in dealing with his daughter.
Right.
And with his the queen. And it's hard to reconcile the greatness with all of the ineptness.
So the question is?
I do not know how to reconcile, you know, his success or, you know, the idea of creating a wonderful version for King James.
I see. Okay. It's true that Cymbeline, as a character, seems to be henpecked at the beginning, to be overborne by this kind of stereotypically wicked queen slash stepmother slash stage mother, because she's very, very focused on this son, Cloten. He seems then to be completely nonplussed when good news comes his way. We never see him, except at the very, very end, assume any kind of what we would now call leadership. Should that make us feel as if the play is not a model of good kingship? That's a good question. How do other people feel about this? Anybody want to recuperate Cymbeline as a character?
I don't know if this is pushing it, but it does seem as though Cymbeline's country and government has been hijacked by forces that are maybe even smarter than he is. I'm not sure, at least for the time being. The evil stepmother certainly is billed as a very intelligent woman. And it's a contemporary production of that play might play on that issue for some of us who feel that the government in this country has been hijacked and that better times are coming.
Well, but toward the end of the play, he actually says, you know, it's my fault, I shouldn't have been taken in, but on the other hand, she was beautiful and she was persuasive. And so, I mean, there's a whole kind of defense of the queen, or of his why he was taken in by her, at the same time that he says, I should have seen through it, and so on. But plainly, the authority is in the wrong place at the beginning, that this woman whom we see right through from the beginning, because we see that she wants to learn how to use poison to poison little animals. And even Cornelius, the physician, is able to say to us, I know what she's up to, and so I've actually substituted a drug that may be familiar to you if you've read Romeo and Juliet, a drug that's going to make it possible for people to simulate death, but not really to be dead, because I don't trust her. So how is it that if everybody in the audience and everybody on the stage except Cymbeline doesn't see through her, why do we have any respect for him at all?
That too, I mean, because when it comes out in the end, I mean, that she'd really been deceiving him by threatening, I mean, she wanted to kill him. And she, I forget what else, I mean, it was something else, a couple of bad things that she was...
It's everything but having an affair with somebody else, you know. It's
yeah,
really,
but I mean, you know, it was a string of things. I mean, you know, she's particularly evil. I mean, you know, there's nothing, no redeeming.
Well, and on her deathbed, we're told that she says, I never loved you and I only wanted this for the advancement for my son. I mean,
there's a long line of pretty nasty stuff there. And the fact that he didn't see any of this, I mean, is pretty bad. And I think in the beginning, as I remember, aren't there little snippets, too, where people are making fun of him as well as Cloten? Because people are making fun of the son.
Certainly, the first and second lord are extremely...
Yeah, I mean, they're popping these little things. And I think there's some little things against him, too. I mean, the court seems to have lost all respect for him, too.
Right. Right. Well, they see this topsy-turvy ascendancy of the queen. Now, of course, we've seen these evil queens before. Where, in what other plays of ours have we encountered an evil queen? Lady. I mean, if we think of her as evil, I mean, we that's not really a word that we deliberately applied to her. But if you look at the difference between Lady Macbeth or Goneril, say, or even Volumnia, where the mother is so dominant over the son and has ambitions for the son and wants him to present himself in a way that is going to have advancement, where I described her as a kind of stage mother to you, that this queen seems much more cartoon-like, that there's much less sense of her psychic plausibility. And remember, we talked last week about Pericles and about how it moves into the direction of allegory or of a kind of sublime kind of cartoon, that it's and she's not named, yes, Gabe, that's right. She's the queen, and so she is a type, and she's the everybody else has a name. She is a kind of cutout figure, and everything that we learn subsequently about her, from her propensity for poisoning to her deathbed confession, presumably, if we imagine that this is a Christian death somehow, that she needs to die shriven, so she needs to say what the truth is. Nonetheless, this blurting out of this whole list of things, first she said this and then she said that and so forth, has an almost comic quality to it. At the same time, it comes as a real surprise and affront to Cymbeline. Yes?
Well, I think it's in that reverberating that
John Lahr says that Cymbeline's response to being told these terrible things was, oh, well, she looks so pretty, or something.
Yeah, well, you know, remember the passage in which she says, he says, you know,
that was the that was the extent of his response.
Is there more?
Yes.
Seemed to touch him deeply.
Let me find that for you. Thank you very much. So much happens in this play. Act 5, scene 5. Well, see, this is after first she confessed she never loved you, only affected greatness got by you, not you, married your royalty, was wife to your place, abhorred your person. This is, if you were in a creative writing class, and somebody were to say, well, here's the motivation for the character, that you'd think this was way overkill, dial it back. So this is not, in other words, designed to be mimetic or to be verisimilitude. This isn't about what people would really say to other people or how it might. This is really something else. This is really bringing the unconscious into the conscious, that everything is kind of being blurted out at this point. And he says himself, you know, O most delicate fiend, who is it that can read a woman? Is there more? More, sir, and worse. And then we have this whole business about the poisoning and so forth. Mine eyes were not at fault, for she was beautiful. Mine ears that heard her flattery, nor my heart that thought her like her seeming. Well, of course, that theme of seeming, as I pointed out in the chapter that I asked you to read, is all over this play. It had been vicious to have mistrusted her. I would have been wrong to have doubted her. Well, I don't know. Yet, O my daughter, that it was folly in me, thou mayest say, and prove it in thy feeling. Heaven mend all. So even at this point, it's sort of, I can't fix this. I give up. And of course, heaven has been busy mending things up to this point. But this play is everything but the kitchen sink. This play has every possible twist and turn in it. Now, there were, and again, I probably pointed this out to you when I asked you to read, there were people at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century who felt that these late plays of Shakespeare's, especially Pericles and Cymbeline, were a sign that the playwright had really lost it, that he, you know, that what happened to the Shakespeare that we loved, this is just over the top, this is not the Shakespeare, Shakespeare in his dotage, that Lytton Strachey felt this way. Other people have felt that these were the greatest achievement of Shakespearean drama. I don't think that we need to make a comparative judgment necessarily about this play in order to admire what it does do, which is to mobilize very skillfully many of the standard tropes of romance. Remember, we talked about romance last time, and we'll mark out what some of those standard behaviors and activities are, and to mobilize them together with some poetry of transcendent power in order to create a series of narratives of loss and discovery and unification at every possible level. Now, you remember that we talked last time about the gap in the play of Pericles. How long a gap was that again? Do you remember? 14 years. So what we decided was that this allowed the infant babe Marina, born at sea, to grow up, to become an articulate and marriageable woman, and to point toward the all-important theme of renewal through marriage and progeny, which was balanced in that play by seasonal renewal and change and so forth. What happens to that gap in this play? Is there a gap in the middle of the play? It's already happened, exactly. And it's already happened to produce the same thing. That is to say, babies now turn into adults, articulate, active, and marriageable. The stolen away two sons are in the background of the narrative that we have here, and their return forms the same kind of reunion motif as we saw with Marina and Pericles and Thaisa in that play. What about Imogen? Where does she fit into this structure?
She's reborn in the sense that she recovers from this drug, which is supposed to be poison.
Ah, yes. Well, she goes through the death and rebirth syndrome, absolutely.
She also goes through that gender transformation of being a boy for a while and finally revealing herself as a woman again.
Right. That's good. So the two kinds of sort of life, death, male, female, two kinds of transformative activities that happen to her. Yes, please.
That she was rejected by her father and then reclaimed. So that would be another thing.
Right. And that if you know Shakespeare's comedies at all, if you know As You Like It, for example, what makes the romance in As You Like It possible is the exile from the court of the daughters by the angry father, by Duke Frederick. In this case, too, because this is a play, very interestingly, in fact, begins with such high praise of someone that you really think it ought to be a woman. I mean, I'm very struck by the praise of Posthumus at the beginning and the end of the play, that nonpareil, very, you know, the, if you look at the very, very beginning of the play, first you get the whole narrative, get the exposition. And it's a very complicated exposition. So you get it, and you get it with these two gentlemen talking with one another. Very often we've seen this in Shakespearean opening scenes, characters who may not return to the rest of the dramatic action, who are there partly to, who are secondary characters, who are there to tell you what the past was like. You saw that, for example, if you remember in Antony and Cleopatra, where Philo and Demetrius are talking about the infatuation on the part of Antony for Cleopatra. So here we get what's the matter. His daughter has purposed to his daughter and the heir of a kingdom, whom he purposed to his wife's sole son, a widow that late he married, hath referred herself unto a poor but worthy gentleman. She's wedded, her husband banished, she imprisoned, all is outward sorrow, though I think the king be touched at very heart. So here you've got an awful lot of action being encapsulated in this first sentence or two. Now we're going to have the narrative immediately of the loss. And why so, says the second gentleman, the first gentleman, he that has missed the princess is a thing too bad for bad report, that's Claughton, and he that hath her, I mean that married her, alack, good man, and therefore banished, is a creature such as to seek through the regions of the earth for one his like. There would be something failing in him that should compare. I do not think so fair and outward, and such stuff within endows a man but he. This kind of description of the unparalleled personage is very often one that one encounters with the lady, the beautiful lady whom the man is going to go off and seek. And so from the very beginning, it seems to me, there's a lot of unbalance in this play. This rhetoric about the unparalleled Posthumus will return at the end of the play as well. The ordinary rhetorical balance of gender display seems almost from the very beginning to be disturbed. Imogen herself, now some of you will have the Norton edition, which insists that her name ought to be Imogen with two N's, and pointing toward the fact that the historical woman's name was Imogen, and that the two N's could look like an M in old typography and so forth. But obviously the name of Imogen, first of all, became a very popular name at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. We have it in Imogene today, but there are people named Imogen, lots and lots of them. And the fact that her name is somehow like image also became interesting to people. Imogen as an ideal female was a great favorite character on the late Victorian, early 20th century stage. The popularity of the name was connected to the enormous popularity of this play and of this character at that time, that somehow she is, and this is a trouser role again. Remember that these boys' parts, boys are playing the parts of women. in Shakespeare's time, but by the time this play is now put on the stage in the Victorian period, it's an opportunity to see an actress's legs. And this is Imogen spends a good deal of the time in her costume as Fedele, so that it's a kind of ingenue part in which her appearance as a boy with all of, and notice how successful is her masquerade as Fedele. She's successful as a boy, kind of, but they read her in a different way, don't they? What do the boys immediately see about her? Beautiful, absolutely. And somehow they feel a recognition. They feel a kinship. One of the boys says to the father, "I've only met this boy once, but actually, if I have to choose between your death and the death of this boy, I choose your death." The whether one wants to look at it in fairy tale terms, in psychoanalytic terms, in terms of the believability of it, that something is happening here that is not meant to merely replicate conscious human utterance and conscious human behavior. Everybody, they see and they don't see. They recognize her and they don't recognize her. They don't recognize explicitly that Fedele, the faithful one, the page, is a girl. But they see, it's like Violet in Twelfth Night, they see the fresh complexion, they see the timorousness. No, indeed, you seem kind of sickly, you should stay at home, don't go to the battle, don't go hunting, stay here and cook. It's a boy, but it's a young boy, and so stay at home. The everything but "you seem like a girl" is said to him, her, and "we feel like you're brothers." Yes, it's like you're my brothers. It's the recognition that is not quite a recognition is very powerful in that scene. One can imagine it. Now, I've not seen this production in New York, but one can imagine it played for laughs, or one can. That would be one way to. Outsmart it, so to speak, would be, it's like that moment in Much Ado About Nothing where Beatrice says to Benedict, says, "What can I do to help you out?" And Beatrice says, "Kill Claudio." And the audience is extremely struck by this, and you can play that line for laughs as a way of trying to deal with the fact that this is a disconcerting observation. Yes?
The boys and the not the father, but I mean, he is the father to them.
Hilarious,
but I mean,
yes.
Yeah, but uh-huh. I mean, he's the kidnapper.
Right.
She comes upon him. I mean, and they've been living in the woods. I mean, and they're depicted as semi-animals, essentially. And then suddenly you get this. She comes in from a court.
Right.
It's a very strange the way it suddenly goes that they're all equal and they're. They're just as articulate, just as bright, just as... they're essentially semi-savages in one sense.
This is the pastoral tradition of the noble savage. This is a play absolutely full of wonderful embodied literary cliches. And again, Shakespeare is better than anybody I know at taking something that can be read as part of a narrative and putting it on the stage and giving it a different kind of valence. So this is a tradition in the pastoral of the noble savage, of the person who brought up not in the court, but in the country, has all the natural graciousness of a civilized person because they're not contaminated by the court. Very often, such noble savages turn out to be highborn after all. So you've got a kind of twofer here. You have both they're not spoiled by the contamination of the wicked city. Remember the brothel in Pericles, or what would be the contaminating elements about the wicked city or cities in this play? I mean, what we learn from Belarius, from Morgan, as his Welsh name is.
Cause great harm to each other.
Absolutely. These are the cliches of what's bad about the court. Again, it's flattering, it's glozing, it's lying, it's betrayal, it's set up. So he was set up to take the fall about something. So he flees with, because he's been accused of something, he flees with the two sons to the country. And he has persuaded the their nurse, Eurypyle, what does it mean? What's the etymology of Eurypyle? Love, yes, okay. Okay, we'll come back to that. He's persuaded this nurse to kidnap the boys, for which he marries her, very much like, again, for those of you who know Twelfth Night, the promise that Sir Toby Belch makes in Twelfth Night, that he will marry the waiting gentlewoman Mariah for the device that she performs on his behalf. So this trope of the trick performed by the lower-born lady, the gentleman marries her as a result. She conveniently dies and is not present in this structure in which we again have these maternal fathers. Once again, both with Cymbeline and also with Valerius / Morgan, we have a father with a memory of the mother. The mother, it's a good mother, not a bad mother, but she's dead. So the good mother is dead, the bad mother is alive. This is the same kind of split that you see in Hamlet, with the good father is the dead father, that is old Hamlet. The living father is Claudius, the sexual rival, and the political rival. In this case, we have the one story of Cymbeline and his wicked, very powerful, poisoning, child-hating wife. And the other, we have the good mother who commits an act that looks like a bad act, kidnapping, after all, and who dies, but whose kidnapping actually turns out to be a good thing because she preserved them alive, she preserved them away from the wicked court. And in fact, it's a medial state, it's a liminal state, it's going to return to the, going to return better to the court. They're going to return having performed a noble action, having done what knights do, that is to say, done some feat that will return them to the court. And remember Cymbeline's ambivalence about this when he thinks that Guiderius, his older son, this is Polydor. Polydor is the Welsh name of Guiderius. Polydor, all gifts. He thinks that that the killing by Polydor of Cloten is going to cost him his life. Then when he discovers that it's his son, and this is in fact, you know, a justified murder rather than Guiderius says, "Well, I don't care. I'm glad I did it. He was a bad guy, and you know, I'd do it again. I'm glad he didn't kill me." There's no cravenness about these characters. Well, they're noble. Spiritually noble, they're naturally noble, and when it is discovered, and we'll see this next week with Winter's Tale as well, when it's discovered that in fact their natural nobility is paired with an actual nobility, when hierarchy and nature come together here, you have the pastoral return. Belarius himself is another cliche of a pastoral character, that is the courtier exiled from court, the courtier who leaves the wicked court and goes into the countryside in order to escape its wickedness, and in this case to escape from the a threat to him. But he is he's paired here with this notion of the lost, kidnapped children who will return, and keeps us in the picture, so to speak, explains to us from the beginning who they actually are, and that their nobility seems natural. So I've forgotten where we started with this. They're described certainly. Well, it's not as if they're kind of gnawing bones, I think. We don't quite have a sense of them as they are uncouth. I mean, they're uncouth in the sense of unlearned. Yes.
Also in his little explanation of things says how hard it is to hide the sparks of nature.
Right.
It seems to me there's an implication of the genetic quality here that's going to triumph as well.
Exactly. These boys little know that they're the sons of the king, nor Cymbeline knows that they're alive. So he's going to give us this outside-inside thing again. They behave nobly, even though they don't know that they're noble. And he keeps saying to them, "No, but we're just country folk, and we have no expectations, and so forth." And they are restless. Notice that they are restless. That this will also happen in the pastoral. That they want to they want action. They want to go to war. They want to grow up. They want to get out of this moment of the cave. I mean, what could be more womb-like? The cave, the motherly father, the protection away from the world and so forth. They want to get back into the world. And they do so both because of the war that is impinging, but also because of the arrival of Cloten in their neighborhood and the what amounts to a kind of slaying of the monster or slaying of the giant. If this were a real romance, that is, say, if it were Spenser or some other kind of prose romance rather than a dramatic romance, Cloten would be even more inhumanly monstrous than he is. As it is, he's described as ill-fitting himself. He's got somebody else's clothes on. He doesn't know how to fight. They joke about him and so forth. He's about as monstrous as a human being can be. And especially, he's not a good prince. He doesn't behave in a princely way. So that Guiderius's killing of him, which again is a motivated killing, he's provoked, and the cutting off of his head and the putting of the head in the stream flowing down to Ludstown is a kind of knightly challenge. It's a kind of approving of himself. And it's that, we could say, to speak in total cliche, that turns the boy into a man. That this is the moment of proving himself as a soldier, as a warrior, as not a child, that catapults them back into that world of war against the father's wish, and thence back. And this, again, the idea that Valerius says to them, I was in danger in the court, I really shouldn't go back. Again, readers of Twelfth Night may remember that a very similar thing happens with the captain and Sebastian in Twelfth Night, where again, Orsino and the captain were at odds with one another once in a sea fight. I did him harm. It is dangerous for me to go back, so I won't go back. But ultimately, his love for Sebastian, his affection for Sebastian, leads him back into this place of danger. So also here, another adoptive parent or relation is led back into the danger of the real world, we could say, by the love that he bears to these children. That rather than stay behind and save his own skin, he will go back with them. So this is just to give you some sense of the place of the pastoral in this play. What is the place of the comedy per se? What are the comic elements in the play? I mean, the dramatic comedy, like romantic comic elements in the play. We've touched upon some of them, but we haven't named them as comic.
Is smuggled into the bedroom,
uh-huh,
of Imogen, and wakes up and makes note of everything that's in there.
And why do you associate that with comedy?
It's part of this gamble, part of this wager.
Yes.
And because it's part of the wager, it's. You know, it's a play on the infidelity or the belief in fidelity by the husband and it's a comment on human nature.
It's the romance or tragic consequence of what looks like a comic exchange. This is a kind of boys' thing. All the guys are together.
Right.
The stage direction explains that maybe the Spaniard and the Dutchman are mutes and don't have speaking parts and may actually be part of the scenery. They don't have speaking parts in the scene at all. Maybe they're drunk. Maybe who knows what. But the other participants, the Frenchman, the Italian Giacomo or Giacomo, and Posthumus, the Briton, are having this kind of conversation about my girl is better than your girl, or all ladies are unfaithful, or whatever it is. And it escalates very quickly into a kind of war, but it's a merry war, again, to use the phrase from Much Ado. It seems to be a kind of verbal war about whose lady is faithful, whether ladies are ever faithful. And ends with this wager that they, where again, somebody keeps trying, the Frenchman keeps trying to say, it's enough already, let's not go any further, let's not pursue this. But Posthumus and Iachimo are engaged in this wager, and the result is this, the bedroom scene. I want us to look at the bedroom scene very closely in a minute. But let's just name some other things about the play that are like Shakespearean romantic comedy. But we've talked a little bit about the cross-dressed Imogen, the plucky heroine who has to cross-dress in order to be an agent in her own salvation, in her own rescue, and who winds up, in fact, transforming the lives of others in her guise as somebody else. This is a common. This is something that is found in Shakespearean comedy, in Rosalind in As You Like It, in Viola in Twelfth Night, in Portia, in Merchant of Venice. All of these plays, many years before Cymbeline. This is a return to something that happened earlier in Shakespearean comedy. You know this because these plays were not part of our syllabus. That is to say, they are earlier rather than later Shakespeare. They are Elizabethan rather than Jacobean Shakespeare, and they are moments in which women's agency and the limits of women's agency are tested and discussed, but the woman's in disguise becomes quite powerful and is able in a way to manage the reconciliations and indeed to some extent the education of her chosen husband or husband-to-be.
Black comedy about the conversation with a headless corpse.
Yes.
I mean, it's...
Right.
It has to be sort of comical.
Okay, good. I'll talk about it in just one second. Let me just finish this other thing about Imogen in her cross-dressed guise. Because when Shakespeare returns, and again, this is a stock figure from Pastoral as well, the disguised lady out in the woods and so forth, because she's disguised in order to protect herself. A woman alone, dressed as a woman, is a more vulnerable figure. But here, too, she assumes a name, an emblematic name, and many names in this play are emblematic. The name Fidele, the faithful one. How faithful is she, this faithful one, incidentally? Who's she faithful to in the course of this play? When she is Fidele, who does she serve? She ultimately serves Lucius, yes, the Roman, and comes back as his, when she thinks all is lost, comes back in the last scene, and he says, you know, save my page, I don't care about me. Again, the same move again, and you're such a beautiful young man, of course, I've never met you before, though you look oddly familiar, says Cymbeline, but I will grant you, because somehow you're so wonderful, I'll grant you one wish. Lucius says, I'm sure you'll choose me as your one wish, although I'm not asking for that. And she says, well, no, actually not that. Actually, I want to know why this guy is wearing this bracelet. So, I mean, it's all the expectations and the disappointments of those expectations. It's a very knowing use of these tropes or these conventions. Everything is out there and everything is somehow sophisticated to the point where it could seem either very naive or very droll at the same time. They keep being expectations, deceptions, reversals, which are surprising to characters on stage, but really not so surprising to us. And if we imagine that, this play full of recognition scenes, but if we imagine that unfolding recognition scene with Imogen sort of seeing the brain, I mean, there's got to be some sort of hyperacting moment in which she notices this jewel on the arm of Iachimo that leads her away from Lucius. So the separated lovers, again, whether this is in tragedy as in Romeo and Juliet or whether it's in comedy, the separated lovers and their return, their future destiny blessed at the end of the play, somewhere buried in here is a Shakespearean romantic comedy between Posthumus and Imogen, and that's predicted at the very, very beginning of the play in that little pre-speech that I read to you between the two lords about he that hath her, but he doesn't really have her because the father wants to exile them and so forth. Now let's just try that. Okay, so the headless, this grotesque scene in which Imogen wakes up from her feigned sleep, from the drug that she takes that they think leaves her dead. Then there's the funeral. It's such a wonderful place. The funeral in which there happens to be a little graveyard right there because the mother, Eurypyle, the supposed mother, the former nurse, is buried there. And so they're going to bury the page Fidele there. But then they decide that this noble Cloten, noble, how do they know he's noble? How do they know he's noble? Yes. Sorry. He said so. Right. Okay. So he's the king's son. And he's dressed how? In posthumous' clothes. He's dressed in posthumous' clothes. And he's dressed in posthumous' clothes, again, because of a figure of speech. Because Imogen says to him, posthumous' meanest garment is more interesting to me than you are. I would not marry you, you know, under any circumstances. And he takes great umbrage at this meanest garment, and so he addresses himself in the meanest garment, leading up to this misrecognition scene, in which she says, oh my goodness, here's the leg, here's the foot, this is posthumous. She doesn't say, gosh, these look like posthumous' clothes, but they don't fit this corpse very well. She doesn't say, she seems to recognize the body without the head as that of posthumous, which leads her to flee and to move off to the wars. Sorry, yes, exactly. But as you, it's quite grotesque. It's absolutely grotesque to have this sort of anti-love scene between Imogen and this headless corpse, in which it's a recognition scene and a misrecognition scene, in which she seems to recognize, and it's a kind of anti-blazon too. You know what a blazon is? A blazon is the traditional praise of the beautiful lady's face. Her eyes are like suns, and her lips are like cherries, and so forth. It's common in love poetry and in sonnets of the late 16th century. So that when Shakespeare comes to write his anti-blazon, my mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun, he is writing against this traditional kind of Hallmark card-like discussion of the beauty of the lady. The word blason or blazon comes from the word for emblem or flag here, and it's a kind of itemization of the beauties of the lady's face. Almost always describes a woman. The only time, the two places I can show you where it describes a man are in the Midsummer Night's Dream and also in Chaucer's Sir Thopas. In both cases, it describes a kind of sickly, unbeautiful man. But in this case, you get the blazon below the neck, so to speak. You get the itemization of parts of a man without the head. So you get what is a sort of wonderful inversion of a convention of love poetry toward the grotesque, because there's no head, and also she seems to be recognizing every little piece of him and praising every little piece of him, even though it's in fact not him. And we've elsewhere heard that this particular body is not to be praised. I think we've reached the point where we should take a little pause. Then we'll come back and we'll actually look at some of the text of this play. Okay, well, in the break, I was chatting with somebody about the phenomenon which is often these days described by scholars of music or of art or of literature as late style, the late style of Rembrandt, the late style of Picasso, the late style of Beethoven, the moment when in the work of an artist who has achieved a considerable amount and has gone through a set of images over and over again in different keys, now is able to paint with looser brush strokes or looser pen strokes, to suggest rather than to nail down everything, to gesture towards something, to have a kind of elegiac note in what he or she does, but really to quote in a way from previous work and to give it a kind of profundity, which is partly because of its suggestiveness rather than its it's because it's a quotation or an allusion or a suggestion rather than nailing everything down. And I think with this play we have, and indeed with all of these late plays of Shakespeare, we have a wonderful example of late style. Now, the literary critic Edward Said, who was also a music critic, wrote about late style in Beethoven and late style in music altogether. And these plays are often called Shakespeare's late plays or late romances. And there is a sense, and we talked about this a little bit when we talked about Pericles, in which he is revisiting in these plays some themes and indeed some situations and some kinds of characters that we saw in earlier plays by Shakespeare. What king in other Shakespearean plays does Cymbeline seem to resemble to you, if anyone? Or does
he has the rashness of King Lear.
He has the rashness of King Lear. What also was King Lear's domestic problem at the time that we encountered him?
Daughters.
So, daughters, yes. In this case, a multiplicity of daughters, but the marriage of one. And the question, again, a question that we could say is itself quoted from the dilemma of Shakespearean comedy, of the father wishing to ordain the marriage of the daughter and the daughter wanting to assert her independence. We saw this in Othello as well, by choosing her own partner, her own mate here. In the case of Desdemona in Othello, in the case of Cordelia in King Lear, bad things happen. In the case of Romeo and Juliet, exactly. Daughter's independence is dramatically spectacular, rhetorically, enormously powerful, and the result in terms of the dramatic outcome is that the daughter dies, the father is left to mourn, to understand his own mistaking, and ultimately the sense is one of loss. The kingdom loses, the Montagues and Capulets lose, there is no continuity. The continuity has to come from outside. In this case, that same rebellion of the daughter chooses her husband against the father's wish, turns out he's pointing her in every bad direction, she is choosing somebody whom everybody from line four of the play says is the most spectacular guy that ever came to Britain, and the result is that everybody wins, that she seems to die like Juliet but comes back to life like herself. That Posthumus, whose name, and we should talk about his name, from the very beginning suggests late style, that he is belated from the very beginning, and I want to say another word about his name in just a second, returns from his various transformations and disguises, and they live happily ever after, so that romance and comedy intersect with history and tragedy in order to produce a kind of rich dynastic stew here, a rich answer at the end of the play to the question of how you build the history of Britain, how you build a dynastic family, how you assert the continuity between Britain and Rome rather than the war that seems to sunder it. Now, Posthumus's name, which literally means born afterward, right? So a posthumous publication is one that's done after the author is dead. In what sense is posthumous posthumous?
He's born after his father died.
Born after his father died, and we learn at the very end of the play also, did he know his mother?
Mother
dies in childbirth. So he is he's fulfilled this fantasy that we saw Coriolanus want, as if a man were author of himself and knew no other kin. Here we have Posthumus with the father he never knew and the mother who dies when he is born. And who, yes, please. And the brothers, exactly. So he's got this name, Leonidas, posthumous Leonidas, that turns out to be a riddle that needs to be unpacked. And in the unpacking of the riddle, he gets also to have a family reunion. He gets to have, in his dream, this reunion with the father, the mother, the brothers. He gets to recuperate the degree to which he is posthumous. And so that there, the two sets of family reunions that happen here, the one in the family of Cymbeline and also the one in the family of Posthumus. But Posthumus's parentlessness gives him, at the beginning of the play at least, a certain kind of independence, which is quite in contrast to the fact that everybody else seems to have parents, and indeed rather obtrusive and controlling parents, and may also be related to the fact that he seems so universally admired, and like a comet, like a piece of magic and so forth, that they describe him as if, in fact, he wasn't born of Matt, as if there wasn't a sense of his having become somebody, but already having been somebody. At the same time, it's not altogether, it's not a great theatrical role. There's not a lot in the part of Posthumus compared to the parts of some of these other characters. That he is praised a lot at the beginning, at the end, but how much of an actor actually is he? How much does he actually get to do? It's a little bit like, you know, Romeo with respect to Juliet, but Juliet has the bigger part. The parting at the beginning of the play of this pair, again, normally a marriage would end a comedy. The traditional end of romantic comedy is marriage. This is a play that begins with the news of a marriage and therefore of a parting. So again, it turns that convention inside out. This leads, on the one hand, to this scene that we saw of the, he goes back, so to speak. I mean, if you were to think about this normative evolution of the young adult from a crowd of friends into a one-on-one relationship with a life partner, as with Romeo and Mercutio and all the guys he's out brawling with, and then his choice of Juliet or Benedict and all the other figures in the wars, and then finally his choice of Beatrice. So here we have the reverse of that again. First, the love affair takes place off stage, the marriage takes place off stage, the separation of the two, Posthumus and Imogen. And then, as if he's living it backwards, this boys will be boys conversation that he has with Iachimo and the Frenchman and the mute Spaniard and Dutchman. This kind of braggadocio about my girl is better than your girl, it seems as if it ought to come prior to, psychologically prior to, the scene of the marriage. But in fact, it comes after it, and it leads, at least temporarily, to disaster. Now, the jealousy of Posthumus, who does that remind you of? Othello. Does it remind you substantively of Othello's jealousy?
Well, he seems so quick to be wary of her.
Yes.
That it's totally irrational.
Completely. I mean, with very few clues. In fact, before Iachimo unpacks his entire bag of tricks,
I'm ready to say, I am convinced.
Even before he sees,
right.
He sees the jewel, he hears about the marks on her body and so forth. Way before that, he's sort of, oh my God, I'm sure. So again, it's as if he were a psychologically conceived character, you would say that, like Othello, there's a certain self-doubtingness about him, that he feels that he is unworthy of her, or that she, in fact, that this was all a mistake on her part. Since he's not a very psychologically conceived character, but only a character who performs behaviors, so to speak, rather than our seeing any psychic development within him, it all seems, again, very quick. It seems to happen very quickly and very much on the surface. He performs jealousy, so to speak, rather than becoming jealous, if I can make that distinction for you. And this would be very consonant with what I said a minute ago about late style. that it is in a way a quote, even if you've never seen Othello, and we'll see next week another character who becomes jealous very quickly, that his utterance is performs that immediate turnaround into jealousy that we might, if we were writing it up clinically, say it happened very quickly, but you'd never actually perform it so quickly. Here it is performed very quickly indeed. Let's just look at that for a second so you can see. Where is it? 2-1 it must be. Oh, sorry. Well, before we look at his jealousy, I'm sorry. We should look at the bedchamber scene first. That's why I've gotten ahead of myself. Because the bedchamber scene is one of the great scenes in all of Shakespeare, I think. This is and it's partly terrific because of the setup. And again, I think I probably write about this in my chapter, that she's been reading. She's gone to bed. And she's in defiance of what books probably looked like in ancient Rome or Britain. She has folded the leaf down of this codex that she's been reading. But what has she been reading? She's been reading about a rape. She's been reading the tale of Tereus. Now, what is the tale of Tereus? Sorry?
It's a rape scene.
Yes, but do you remember the story at all?
The rapes
of Sisyphus. That's right. This is the story of Philomela, who becomes the nightingale. This is the story on which Titus Andronicus is based. Again, you know, if we're thinking about this play as a kind of anthology of other moves of Shakespeare, there's a kind of gesture back toward that horrendous rape that you actually do see on stage with all its physical dismemberment. But she's been reading sensational literature, let's call it that. She's also been reading mythology. So you could say it's high or it's low, but she's been reading about a rape, and she falls asleep. And she's had before this little discussion with Iachimo. Remember that Iachimo has decided that he's going to seduce her one way or another, and so first he comes in and he says, well, Posthumus is a rotter, and he's off sleeping with everybody else, and you made a bad choice, and really, you know, you should pay him back by sleeping with me. And so she is first horrified by these accounts of Posthumus's behavior until Iachimo says, so the way to pay him back is just sleep with me, at which point she understands that this is probably not true and says, you know, you go away. And everyone's, at which point, again, in defiance of ordinary human behavior, he says, no, I was just joking, I was just testing you, just trying to see whether you were virtuous, which I see that you are. You're everything he said he was. He says you were, and he said you were wonderful. Oh, fine, she says. Don't worry about it. No hard feelings. Now he says, can I have a favor of you? Can I please store something valuable? I've been buying old gold plate or silver plate as a gift, and could I, for the Lord I serve, could I please just store it with you for one night? Now, she says, oh, don't worry about it. I'll be happy to store it, but you're my boyfriend's friend, my husband's friend. Stay longer than one night. Oh, no, I can't. Now, why can't he stay for longer than one night? Why won't he hang around the court longer? Well, also because he's going to be in the box. So he can't really stay there because the idea is get the box inside her bedchamber. And, of course, it's her idea to store it in her bedchamber. He doesn't say, would you please store this in your bedchamber? He says, would you put this someplace safe for me? And she says, oh, I've got the perfect place, my bedchamber. So again, it's as if she's functioning in this kind of world of the unconscious speaks. And he puts himself inside this trunk. And then, again, what was it like? Those of you who saw the production in New York, you saw it. What was the scene like?
It's dark, and then at night, this thing very slowly comes up, and it's done with great theatricality.
Yeah.
I mean, he's probably more of a snooper than anything else. I mean,
right.
He's snooping around the room looking for clues, and he's making this map of what the room looks like.
Right.
He's really looking for evidence, and then she, I guess, overturns or something, and that's where he sees this thing on her breast, the mark, So I mean, he's—it's not a very honorable. I mean, he looks like scumbag in there
right.
during this
well,
whole time.
So he
and,
is.
You know, and
right.
you know, and you have this beautiful figure on the bed. I mean, that's the contrast between the two.
Right. So, but we could see that. I mean, if you wanted to think about this play in allegorical terms, you could see this also as a kind of rebirth scene, in which he's. Again, remember that both Marina and Faiza were born out of trunks or containers, or remember the dead body of Faiza wasn't dead and was in the casket and so forth. That in this case, the casket opens up and it's Yakimo, and he is not only you know an active agent, but he's an agent who is both a detective and as you say, completely dishonorable. But is there a sense in which what happens at night while she is sleeping is a kind of dream of hers? Is it a kind of counterpart of what of the rape scene that she was reading, of the perhaps the remembrance of his attempt to seduce her, to which she said no in the conscious, but was she maybe saying something else in her unconscious? It's hard to say, but it's complicated because it's a night scene and because she is on stage and asleep. And when something's happening in her bedchamber while she's on stage asleep, there's some kind of connection between what's happening there and what she may be thinking or dreaming about. So that this is, again, those of you who remember the comedies of Shakespeare, the Midsummer Night's Dream, there's Hermia has a dream while she is lying asleep in the woods, and she dreams that a snake comes and menaces her and so forth, and it's a dream about her boyfriend Lysander, who is lying right near her. So here too, let's look at this just because it's such a great scene. It's Act 2, Scene 2. Where he says, "Our Tarquin thus did softly press the rushes, ere he wakened the chastity he wounded. Cytherea, how bravely thou becomest thy bed, fresh lily, whiter than the sheets, that I might touch, but kiss, one kiss, rubies unparagoned," and so forth. "But my design to note the chamber, I will write all down, such and such pictures, there the window, such the adornment of her bed," and so forth. And as you say, his intention initially is simply to have these clues of the room, and, "O sleep, thou ape of death, lie dull upon her, and be her sense but as a monument thus in a chapel lying." Well, here we might think again about Juliet in her false sleep, the sleep that Romeo thinks is death. And then he begins to sort of take note about her body, and the clock strikes at 1, 2, 3, time, and he goes back into the trunk. So she has been violated. But she has not been violated in the way that a rape scene in Titus Andronicus would take place. She has been violated by his eyes. She has been violated, and immediately now you're going to have Claughton come and talk about penetrating and these puns about the tongue and so forth, in which this image of penetration and violation becomes far more coarsely presented. But this little dream scene in which Yakimo performs an act of spying, which is at the same time a kind of counterpart of what she's been reading, is a kind of model for how we ourselves might read the rest of the play. That the play is, in a way, very much engaged with this question of reading and interpretation. Reading the riddle that descends into the hands of Posthumus, reading the behaviors of characters, reading costumes, a tremendous amount of mistaking of costumes in this play. How many characters can you think of who are wearing costumes not their own? Imogen, obviously. Cloten? Anybody? Posthumus himself, dresses, yeah. Yes, exactly, exactly. And this all this play about inward versus outward, about whether the queen is beautiful from the beginning to the end, but she's wicked inside. The behaviors of certain characters are admirable, but they in fact disclose certain other secrets about them. That there's a tremendous amount of rhetoric in this play about inside and outside, about seeming and being, about the difficulty of reading the surface for the interior. And what's complicated about that is that this is in some ways so much a play of the surface, that this is very much a play about songs and spectacles and not, as we've been saying, a play about psychology or about detectable motivations here. What are the recognition scenes in this play? Recognition and misrecognition scenes.
Yeah. You have Imogen misrecognizing Cloten.
Right.
At the end, there's a ton of them.
It's way over the top. It's like a Saturday Night Live skit. I mean, everybody turns out to be somebody else. Yes, exactly.
And nobody recognizes anybody from the beginning. Imogen doesn't recognize Posthumus, and Cymbeline doesn't recognize his children, and it has to be described to everybody.
Cymbeline does kind of see in the page boy something that looks kind of familiar.
Kind of familiar.
And that, again, that one often sees that in these kind of cross-dressing recognitions. And that may be actually partly theatrically functional. Remember, it's a boy actor playing a woman playing a boy. So in a way, you need some prompt to the audience to remember that he... the observer will be seeing something that we should remember is there, that is an act of cross-dressing, which is actually a redressing in the original gender, so to speak, so that you'll often find this sort of sense that of recognition when it's a penetration of that kind of disguise. But indeed, once again, he fails to see very often. But the play turns on these misrecognitions, partial recognitions, false recognitions, in order to get to the moment at the end of the play when there are these multiple, again, overdetermined, over-the-top sets of recognitions of every possible member of the household and the family, including, remember, first in this final scene, in the beginning of this final scene, they can't find somebody. Who can't they find? Yes?
They can't find the person who was actually Posthumus, who had helped in the battle.
Right, exactly. They can't find that loyal, good soldier. I wish I could reward him. Where is he? Of course, he's right there. But they can't find him because he's changed his clothes. Again, the amount of deliberate misdirection or indirection in that wonderful last scene, which again you could play for laughs if you wanted to, but that has a kind of magic about it. It has a kind of wonder about it, and that word wonder, which is a major word in the English Renaissance, begins to be mobilized in the course of this final act. Do not wonder at it, you can wonder at it, you're a wonder, and so forth. That sense of wonder as a kind of epiphany, as a kind of apparition that appears before you to reveal something to you, that the experience of wonder is partly the experience of the confrontation with something that can't merely be rationalized or can't merely be explained. Yes?
The first sighting of Imogen by her brothers in the cave, didn't they describe it as, maybe they didn't use the word wonder, but something other than...
That would be very nice. Let's see. okay. Yes, here we go. Act 3, scene 7. They've just been out hunting. You, Polydor, have proved best woodsman and are master of the feast. Cadwal and I will play the cook and servant. Peace be here, poor house that keeps thyself. I'm tired, I'm hungry, there's cold meat in the cave, we'll browse on that. I love this idea. Let's nibble, let's have a little nosh before we cook. We'll browse, and really, there's cold meat in the cave, we'll browse on that. Well, and of course, that's an animal word, browse. Whilst we have what we've killed be cooked, looking into the cave, stay, come not in, but that it eats our victuals, I should think here were a fairy. What's the matter, sir? By Jupiter, an angel, or if not, an earthly paragon. And that's, again, highly characteristic of Shakespeare, that he's not going to allow you to take something for supernatural. It's going to be immediately translated into something just like the supernatural, only human. Behold, divineness, no elder than a boy. Enter Imogen. Good masters, harm me not. Here's money for my meat. I would have left it on the board. Money? All's gold and silver rather than turns to dirt. I see you're angry, because of course this is a pre-money economy. This is not about exchange value here. This is not about paying for things. This is about being given things. This is this idea of the pastoral as a place in which generosity rather than payment functions here. What's your name? Fidele, sir. I have a kinsman who's bound for Italy, embarked at Milford, and so forth. Prithee, fair youth, think us no churls, nor measure our good minds by this rude place we live in. You're welcome, boys bid him welcome. Were you a woman, youth? Now, we're going to have that already, the sort of, you know, very close to uncovering or discovery. Again, it's remarkable. Were you a woman, youth, I should woo hard, but be your groom in honesty. I bid for you as I do buy. I'll make it my comfort. He is a man, I'll love him. So too bad he's a man, because I would love him if he were a woman. But since he's a man, I'll love him as a brother. Most welcome. Be sprightly, for you fall amongst friends. Amongst friends, if brothers aside, would it had been so that they had been my father's sons, then had my prize been less, and so more equal ballasting to the posthumous. That is to say, I wouldn't have had so much of an inheritance. I would have been, it would have been easier to marry you, because my being the only heiress to the throne would have been less of a problem. But notice that in this, the course of this little exchange, they've guessed everything. They've guessed that she's a woman. They've guessed that they're brother and sister. They've guessed that the boys are actually not churls but noble. Everything is here. And yet it's as if there's a little scrim in front of it, because we don't want to know this yet. We want to know and we don't want to know. We half want to know, but if we knew now, the play would come to an end. And we don't want the play to come to an end, so it comes this close to discovery. It's like those little scenes in which you see people pass each other, not seeing each other, and you think, aha, I know better. But everything has been said here. So this is a recognition scene in which nothing is recognized. Everything is recognized and nothing is recognized. Everything is said and nothing is said. It's all on the surface and it all goes right back down again. And again, the way she encounters their rudeness, not their bad manners, but rather precisely not their bad manners, their country nature, the fact that their pastoral existence is very much the way Orlando in As You Like It encounters what again turns out to be the Duke and his company in exile in the forest, where they say, come on in and sit down and have a drink. And he says, you know, I thought all things had been savage here. So she has a very similar moment in which she says, oh, I didn't understand that in fact I could find, you know, comfort and welcome and generosity here in the woods, in the cave. And again, it's the double whammy, because on the one hand, you're getting the ideology of pastoral, that people in the country are more gentle, they're untainted by the court, they have natural generosity and so forth. On the other hand, all these people we run into in the country actually belong in the court. They're actually all noble, they're actually all royal, they're there only in terms of exile, so that the nature-nurture come back together again. So what looks like the topsy-turviness of nature is better than nurture turns out to be, in fact, redundancy rather than opposition. But they've been enabled to live in this pristine environment, or this natural environment. Indeed, they're hunting, but they're in nature. And what these plays will often show us, just as King Lear, remember, preferred to be out in the nature, out in rain, out in storm, rather than to be inside where cruelty was really happening, where, as we knew, Gloucester's eyes were being plucked out, where the sisters were behaving badly and so forth, where at least in nature he was in some kind of state that didn't have malevolence attached to it. Whereas in the court here, malice, malevolence is in the person of the queen, who embodies this kind of scientific curiosity about life and death. That she's bored. This is her hobby. She has the Cornelius, the doctor, and notice that every single one of these plays is going to have a kind of doctor magician figure. What was the doctor or magician in Pericles? Remember his name? Saramon, right, as in ceremony. So we had Saramon there, and here we have Cornelius, which would have been recognizable as the name of a German scholar magician. But here, the name of the physician, and again, Shakespeare is fabulously mixing many nations in the choices of these names, that they don't all belong to one national lexicon at all. But here we have Cornelius, who has been educating the queen in a kind of Baconian science. You take a little of this, you take a little of that, and you stir it together, and you get perfume. Or you get, I mean, because it's initially is described as sort of good things, of the using of flowers and so forth. But now she'd like to know. She's rather like Dr. Faustus. She'd like to know, can I do bad things with this? Where's the power? How can I? I'm tired of making soap and lanyards. Now I would like to learn how to make death, please. Just because I'm curious about how these things would work. But I'm not going to use it on human beings, oh no, just on little cats and dogs. Well, you know, Cornelius, in an aside, tells us that he has already figured this out, and that in this moment when she says to him, it's not as if she asks him, he says, what shall I do? Oh, I'll go off and get a fake. But he's already figured this out. So again, it's this wonderful telescoping of things. I knew she was going to ask me to do this, and so I have already prepared this potion that is going to simulate death and, in fact, is only a kind of sleep. So the half of Romeo and Juliet is here truncated into this one little moment. But it's a moment, again, about the queen as a quester after universal knowledge and universal power, and about magical powers, again, the power of life and death. So we have the good physician and the bad physician, again, Cornelius and the queen, and we have a queen who is usurping not only the power to decide, yes, the tribute, no, the tribute, yes, marry Cloten, don't marry Cloten, you shouldn't negotiate with the Romans, all of these masculine roles that where we said, you know, how can we admire Cymbeline when he's so diminished here, but also usurping this Faustian or Faust-like quest to be able to use nature, to harness nature. This is in the action of a scientist to do cruel, bad things, to take life. Somewhere buried here, and I must say that this is something I've not thought about before, somewhere buried in this little description of the queen is a kind of hint of what we're going to see with the benevolent good magician Prospero in The Tempest, who, again, can harness all of these. He's male, but he can harness all these powers. He has books, he has recipes. He is the combination of Cornelius and the queen in one person, and he only uses these powers for good. But her curiosity here is a very early modern curiosity about the uses of science. And it's all, again, made into this kind of negative fairy tale of the wicked stepmother. She's got all the things wrong with her. She's the stepmother. She's dominating the man, the husband. And she wants explicitly to know how to make death work. So again, we might want to juxtapose. Let's look at the various ways in which death appears in this play. That was one thing when I came in here this evening. I wanted to make sure to demonstrate a little bit to you. So we have the queen's potions. Where else does death make an appearance? The beheading Cloten. Okay, good. And then the funerals. So the beheading Cloten, and the other funeral, of course, is Imogen, is the simulated, the apparent death, the mourning over the supposed death of Imogen. Where else? Yes? Death of the queen at the end. Yes, exactly. Where instead of the Macbeth moment, she should have died hereafter, we have this long description of her deathbed words and of her beauty and of her, but exactly, her death. We don't see it, but we hear an awful lot about it. Yes, what else?
Posthumous. Think he's murdered Imogen, or he's had Imogen murdered?
Yes. They both blame Pisanio. It's interesting. They both blame this loyal servant for Posthumus says there are some commands you're better to resist. And again, we'll see that next week. We'll see that in Winter's Tale, where the question of whether you should obey a royal command or a command from an employer that you actually think is a bad idea, or whether you should resist it, will come up again in the Winter's Tale. So he blames Pisanio for presumably killing Imogen, and she blames Pisanio for what? Doesn't she blame him too? She does. If I'm making this up. Because at the end, when we have her say...
Didn't he give her the poison? He gave her the box?
Yes, exactly. You gave me poison. Mm-hmm. She doesn't understand. That because he thought the queen, now why, since he perfectly well sees through the queen too, why he should think that the queen gives to him something that's healthy rather than something that's unhealthy. And again, I know I talk a little bit in my chapter about the small boxes and the big boxes, about the difference between this box of poison, small box that's carried around, and the big box of plate that also contains the poisonous Iachimo inside the bedchamber of Imogen. That these are dream images in a way of one another here, the queen's relationship to these structures. Yes.
Two other occurrences of the death motif are in the jail scene with the executioner or the jailer talking about hanging, and there's a sort of comic interchange on that, and then the battle scenes, and the sort of I can't pinpoint the speeches, but the battle scenes are reviewed in a sort of narrative mode, and a sort of heroic martial talk about the three men in this narrow ditch,
narrow lane, yes,
the narrow lane, holding off and turning the Romans back,
right. Right. I love that passage. I don't know how it played on the stage, but I love that. That first is long description, and then it's reduction into this mythic form. Remember the questions that we saw in Pericles, did you not name a tempest of birth and death? But here, a narrow lane, two boys, the reduction of this, you get it twice. You see it, then you get this long description, then you get its reduction into a kind of mythic, and you can see that this would be the headline. If this were modern history, this would be the headline in the newspaper. The what is it, the narrow lane? There are three things. An old man and three boys. Yes, and two boys. Sorry. Exactly. I love that. Yes. Nell, please.
It's a miniaturized 300.
Sorry.
It's Thermopylae.
Yes. 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 Exactly. Exactly, and you have that sense of, and it's a miracle too. It's a kind of an astonishing moment, and it's also a mythic moment of the turning of the tide in terms of the British fortunes here. And it's done by loyalists. It's done by, I mean, again, think about these images of the Revolutionary War, where it's all people in tatters versus people in major uniforms and so forth. So you get that. But in the final recognition scene, you even find Cymbeline saying to Guiderius, I am sorrow for thee, by thine own tongue thou art condemned and must endure our law, thou art dead. I love that moment again, where he says to, this is when Guiderius the son says, it's me, I killed Cloten. Oh, well, gosh, you know, I was about to reward you with a kind of, you know, purple heart, but instead the penalty of the law is going to come down on you, thou art dead. But it's the present tense that interests me here, because there's so many characters in this play who are the kind of living dead, like the family of Sicinius Leonatus, who come alive and are the living dead here. So the question of life and death is always in flux. Yes.
On I don't know what it is, how you describe it, where one of the boys is over her body, and has that marvelous talk on. The flowers.
The song?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure. Okay. In fact, there's something I want to... In my edition, it does not tell you something completely crucial about this song. I read in the review of the production that this song was spoken rather than sung. I'm not going to sing it, but here it is in Act 4, Scene 2. Again, the songs of Shakespeare are very famous. They're often excerpted. In these late plays, these songs often... This is a play that's got everything. It's got the descent in God. It's got the prophecy come to life. And again, a very clunky prophecy that is read twice so you can figure out. And it's all about etymology and so forth. And it's got all these wonderful songs. Fear no more the heat of the sun, nor the furious winter rages. Thou the worldly task has done. Home art gone and ta'en thy wages. Golden lads and girls all must... as chimney sweepers come to dust. Let's just stop with this stanza for a second. Because does anybody know in English folklore what golden lads are? Yeah. They're dandelions, precisely. So that this is, my edition, which dates from 1955, doesn't even talk about that. About the fact that that the natural round here is being compared to social rank, human existence, and so forth. On the one hand, this says royal, well-born people, lucky people, are just the same in the eye of God or in the angle of life and death as common-born people, chimney sweepers, the gold and the dusty, the high and the low, the fortunate and the unfortunate. But on one hand, this is all about social distinction and how death is the great leveler, but it's also about the naturalness of death. Golden lads and girls almost as chimney sweepers, and of course the chimney sweepers themselves come to do the dusting as well as come to dust, so that they are agents as well as recipients of this notion. Fear no more the frown of the great, thou art past the tyrant's stroke, care no more to clothe and eat. Great and eat would have rhymed in this period. To thee the reed is as the oak, the very slightest, the most powerful. The scepter, learning, physic must all follow this and come to dust. Now this is a very familiar kind of song in Elizabethan language. The idea that they're wonderful early songs about the fear of death and how one must overcome it because the death comes to everybody. Fear no more the lightning flash nor the all-dreaded thunderstone. I hear them coming here. Fear nor slander, censure rash. Thou hast finished joy and moan. All lovers young, all lovers must consign to thee and come to dust. And now there are these four lines in which they strew things on the grave. Now, one of the things that I want to say about Shakespearean songs in relationship to the plays that contain them is that often they, like plays within the play, are the thing that doesn't happen. That this is a description of death and mourning and earthly transformation set over against a play that is going, in fact, to bring everyone back to life, in which even the really dead, the parents of Posthumus, are going to reappear on stage. But enclosed in the song, and we can see this even in the full song in King Lear, enclosed in the song is both metamorphosis and transformation and the round of life and death. And the song will both present it and hold it away from fulfillment, because in fact nobody is going to die in this play. I mean, somebody is, Cloten's going to die, but the rest of the figures. Cloten is in a way the sacrifice here. That Cloten and the mother are, and we could go back to the end of Macbeth, in which there's a kind of cleansing of Scotland from the evil Macbeths. Here there's a cleansing of England from this widow and her son, who is the king's stepson, so that everybody else can be reborn back into their old existences. So the figures who seem to be themselves turn out to not be themselves, whereas the figures who seem not to be themselves all turn out, in fact, to be reborn into a different kind of existence. Was there more that you wanted to ask about the song? It's a beautiful song as it's performed, but the combination here of the story about social class and the story about the natural round, and here just to finish this up, as we'll see in the plays that are to come as well, the third piece here is the jewel, which is almost always in these plays an equivalent of virtue, but we saw that with Desdemona, One Entire and Perfect Chrysolite, but here becomes also a token of fidelity and that which is not changed by time, by rain, by wind, by anything like that. So that we've got three stages. We've got the natural round, we've got the human, and we have the eternal as figured in the jewel. And we'll see all of those things again in The Winter's Tale. So I'll see you next week.